just an accident of circumstance happening.
Uh-huh.
And so that was the war, running these machines, teaching math. When they turned me down, there was not that summer, I didn't quite know what I would do, but then in the fall came the first wave of GI students, so all of a sudden they needed just the opposite, they needed English teachers.
They needed instructors again.
But meanwhile, in the summer, I was a copy editor for the Bangor Daily News.
Were you?
But anyhow, I ended up back in the English department, and that was what I did the rest of my life, I guess, teaching English and writing.
Well, you had a variety of things
but
there.
But it was, as I say, things that I had never done before.
For a short period of time.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the case with a lot of people.
Oh,
a lot of people
were
doing things that they never did again. Yeah. Once the war finally ended.
Oh, yes. New people and people that I meet them in class, but the way the other people live, I guess.
Uh-huh. Now, moving on to San Diego State College. When you came in 1954, you say that possibly that when you were hired, it was the second hiring wave after the war.
I think so, because along with me in 55 came Glenn Sandstrom, Bill Perkins, Lowell Tozier, and
mm-hmm.
somewhere in there came John Monteverdi. He might not have been that year, he might have been the next year or so. But four or five of us right in at that time.
Right.
I say three, the same year I came, that makes four right that one year, 55. And I think that was the second wave. I can't swear there might have been a wave between 46, 7 and something and 55. I don't know.
Okay.
But I don't think so. I think looking at those, looking at that picture you showed me, I think that... I think those are more the first people, the ones that are shown there.
Uh-huh.
And then just the next year came all these other people. And then came still a third wave, and I can't tell you the date of that. I wanted to quote Mark Twain to you and ask you to discount everything I say about 20 or 30%, because he said that when I was younger, I could remember anything. But now when I was younger, I could remember anything, whether it happened or not. But now that I'm getting older, I can only remember the latter, he said. Or I soon will be able to remember only the latter.
Well, I tell you, that's one.
But anyhow, a third wave, there definitely was a third wave, and this is kind of a, it must have been in the 60s, and certainly they had the point of view of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
These were the young, eager, they seemed somewhat extreme or radical or what have you, but they were, and also I guess it was from their point of view. I realized this at the time, and I've realized it more since. It must have been kind of hectic. I mean, there was terrific pressure to advance, to get ahead, and I guess there were a lot of them competing with each other, so kind of an overpopulation. In one way, they all agreed to get ahead would be just to get rid of the pitch out the ancients, the war horses, get rid of them as fast as possible.
Was there that attitude? Was there that
overriding
philosophy there?
There was a conflict.
Was there really?
For a while.
The old school
they, their method was they wanted to have promotions based. Well, this is the impression that we had was that promotions based on publication, because they could do that.
Right.
And it had been seniority, pretty much, seniority. For example, the department chairmanship went by seniority.
Uh-huh.
And it was approaching my turn, and I was delighted when this other wave came in, and they decided they'd have to make it more democratic and do it by election. And I could escape that way, and I had no desire. So
uh-huh.
I think if it had been seniority, perhaps I would have felt... there would have been a different kind of pressure. My colleagues would have said, oh, no, we hate this also. We suffered through it. I would have felt I had to suffer through it too. Whereas this way it was fine.
You never did service department chair.
No,
boy, are you lucky? You got out of that one.
There was some demand. There actually was demand for me to do it, especially when these conflicts got worse, because I was supposed to be a kind of a bridge.
Uh-huh.
The new wave. I was told by those in the old way, well, they accept you, George, because you publish, so
mm-hmm.
go ahead and
mm-hmm.
do this. But there were two things about me. They said, they accept you because you publish, that's good. Your ideas are bad, that's bad, but you publish, that's good. So I had no interest in that.
You know what I find is kind of an interesting conflict during the 60s, and
that's
certainly it is
place.
Conflict right now, is that so much emphasis was put on getting ahead, publishing, doing research, but at the same time they say that this is supposed to be a teaching school.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be a teacher training school, or teaching school, not teacher training school any longer. Did you see that, the same
that was
kind
one
of
thing
a conflict
that I, that was one thing that I enjoyed about both Maine, I feel I was fortunate that way about both Maine and San Diego State, is that when I was at the University of Maine, publishing was sort of an oddity, sort of an eccentricity, if you wanted to do it okay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty much seniority there, passage of time, and they really meant passage of time, 6 years for this, 6 years for
uh-huh.
that, 6 years for the other.
Uh-huh.
And, but I, when I left Maine, I was an associate professor, and another 4 or 5 years I would have been passage of time, I guess. But I didn't feel any pressure there. I liked to write. I wanted to do it, but I didn't want to feel that I had to do
yeah.
it. And I didn't
yeah.
feel that way, and I didn't feel that way when I came here. It was not that way in the 50s. Again, it was if you wanted to do it, fine, but it didn't make much difference. Things went, your turn came to be chairman, your turn came to be promoted. That was it. It was your turn.
But then that eventually changed, though.
Oh, yes.
That
in the 60s, this big conflict
you have
arose,
to
and I think ever since then, I would imagine that, well, I know that being on promotion committees and so on, they're supposed to be, I forget now how they phrase it, anyhow, the scholarship, the teaching, and the university service, these three things.
Right.
And the emphasis will vary, of course, but you, nowhere in there is specifically stated what was kind of at least the unwritten rule before, the just seniority. The people who did want to continue some allowance for that tried to put it in under, they said, how do they put it? I forget the phrase now. It amounted to seniority, but that was a bad word. Service. They had a phrase for it, I forget it.
Uh-huh.
But no, and when I was on promotion committees, there were those three things, and you could kind of vary the emphasis according to the way the committee felt. But seniority was not supposed to be any factor at all from
yeah.
that time on.
Yeah.
And that was the fight, that was the kind of the unspoken conflict part of it, when the new people came in and wanted to get everything quickly. And as I say, they couldn't do I don't know what they could do. They didn't really start a movement to demote the other people who had not published much, but they there was bad feeling, there's some bad feeling.
Uh-huh.
He's a dummy, he hasn't done anything since his thesis and so forth and so on. And look, I've got this whole string of articles
uh-huh,
last
right.
year and this year
right.
and this year and so.
I understand the competition was real tight.
So it probably
it was
must
very
have
rough.
Been. I was glad. That was one thing I was glad about. Our son David, he was teaching there. I can't even think of the school up there. One of the state system schools in the L.A. area. Northridge? Is there a Northridge?
There's Northridge up there
in
the L.A.
area.
I guess
that must have been where he was. And he got caught by the first big cutback. He had just secured his tenure. He was publishing and so forth and so on. And but then they cut the department by a third.
Mm.
And he was so he came. They decided they wanted to be down here. He could have gone to some colleges in the Middle West. Decided to be down here. And of course, you don't want this about him especially, but to illustrate this thing, he taught at San Diego State, and they had a department there which was a kind of an adjunct to the writing department, and they offered him the permanent thing there. At the same time, though, all of the community colleges were competing for him here because he had a national reputation as a tennis player. They wanted him to coach tennis, they wanted him to teach English and history and so on.
Uh-huh.
He had a PhD in his tennis, and each one of them wanted. And I said, well, you know, whichever you think, Dave, but if you do San Diego State, get them to write things, get it in writing, because I
what
could see
what they expect
all
of you mean.
Yes,
yes.
And what they would offer him in the future and so forth and
uh-huh.
so on. And he decided on the other, and he's been very happy there. I think he made the right decision.
Where is he?
Miramar.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, that's undergoing a big expansion there. And he doesn't want administration any more than I have, but he's been running two departments there off and on. He's a pillar. He was one of the kind of the founders there. So if he wanted to be a dean or a president, I suppose he could be. He doesn't. He's getting a book out. He's had two or three books published. And
has he really?
Yeah.
Well, that runs in the family for you.
But,
his
yeah.
name is David.
Yeah, David. And Freya has her book on fellowships, you know.
I didn't know she's published as
oh,
well.
Oh, yeah, she has a book on grants. Yeah, and she edited a magazine on grants, a review
uh-huh.
for years. Maybe she's still editing that. I don't know.
Well, I should ask her about that next time I see her.
Yeah, ask her about her
book. Which should be very soon, as a matter of fact.
Well, whatever your questions, I'm shooting off the subject again.
Well, actually, it's all related to what we're talking about the conflict between.
Yes, in the 60s, that was
teaching
it.
And publication.
Further little item on the conflict, but I don't know. I get that. Anyhow, I'm certain this really happened, and as I say, but I was not present at the time. But this conflict, I say, being rather creating rather strong feelings. One of the newcomers. And then one of the old guard is supposed, after a meeting in which this had been debated rather violently, a good department meeting,
uh-huh.
and they go out on the gallery of the, what's the name of the building now, the old Arts and Science Building, the center of the whole campus there.
Hepner Hall?
Yeah, on the gallery there, the second floor.
Yes, uh-huh, Hepner Hall.
And the older member is supposed to have punched the new aggressive member in the nose.
Is that right?
And the new member is supposed to have threatened a big lawsuit about that, and there nothing ever happened. And of course, the peculiar thing is, I learned later, I think that the newer member, who was one of the most aggressive, had been a combat soldier in World War II.
Mm.
But on the other hand, the one who did the punch, well, again, I'll be careful, I won't identify him, but he was
a very dramatic
character also. And anyhow, that was one of the highlights of that particular week.
I've heard about other instances of arguments coming to fisticuffs on campus also.
Yeah.
It's just common knowledge in this day and age. I understand your concern about not making the names known.
Yeah.
I understand that. That's perfectly fine. Well, since we're on this sort of thing and we're talking about the old school and the new school, I've got a list of names of people that I'm kind of curious about.
Sure, go ahead.
You just tell me whatever you can think of off the top of your head about any of these individuals.
Sure.
What do you have to say about John Theobald?
Well, John was a great teacher. He was, I think, at one time going to be a preacher. He was very eloquent, and he came to see us. It was a very comforting thing that he did when we lost our son to leukemia. He and Mary Lee, his wife. I remember John talking to us about it. John was very much interested in philosophy. He went to India after his retirement to be in touch with Hindu philosophy and something
mm-hmm.
of that sort. And he talked very eloquently to us that particular week after the loss. He was interested in tennis. He was a tennis player. His daughter, Jill, was in our guest cottage for a while. I was renting our guest cottage for a while. She's an artist. She's a painter.
I know her.
And you know
my
Jill.
Husband used to work
well,
with
Jill
her.
Jill can tell you. She can probably give you some other sidelights about us. And his boys, Johnny, our boy whom we lost, taught his second son, I forget his name now, was giving tennis lessons at one time to John Theobald's son.
Oh, I didn't. I only know Jillian. I don't know all the other.
John Theobald was a very eloquent teacher, and
a very good author, very good writer as well.
A very good writer. Oh, his book on the French and the translations. That's an excellent, outstanding introduction that he did to that book. You know his book, don't you?
I don't know.
Oh, translations from French 19th, 20th century poets, published by a local press downtown. A very handsome volume. He asked us to read the introduction, a long introduction, very, very well written, very eloquent, which we did. We had nothing to say about it except it was outstanding before the book was published.
And
you should get hold of his book.
We probably have it. I'm sure we have it. This wasn't done by Brighton Press, was it?
Excuse me?
Was it a Brighton Press book?
That sounds
like one of the fine presses in San Diego.
It's around here somewhere, but it would take me a while to dig it out.
We can find that one later.
Yeah. So John, yes, okay. John was outstanding. We knew John well. He came to watch the boys' tennis matches. As I say, his boys were interested in tennis.
Uh-huh. What are your thoughts about? Let's see here. Let me take a pick here. Chester Kennedy.
Well, Chet had the story, one anecdote about Chet, of course. He had a hearing aid, and that when things got too dull or not of his, he turned it off. He turned it on and off according to his interesting conversation.
He was one of those.
And that he heard more than he let on, that he heard and so forth. And I suppose that's a common anecdote about people with that age, that thing. Chet was, of course, he was in his education, his background was education, I believe, and I believe he taught those who were going for their education,
for the credentials.
Certificate credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his field. I didn't know much about that. He was
mm-hmm.
I don't know how to describe it. He was just sort of a gruff, straightforward character.
Speaking of gruff and straightforward characters, that's kind of my opinion of George Phillips.
He was my office mate.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he was a New Englander, a Dartmouth man.
Uh-huh.
His field was chimney sweeps. He had all kinds of apparatus, chimney sweep apparatus in his home, and he was in the office with me down at the social science building for some years.
As a little aside, we have all of his research material in special mm-hmm. collections. We have his
Good.
Collection,
Good.
And many of his books as well, research notes, books, mm-hmm. photocopies of periodical articles, and as much of his artifact collection as survived the
good.
Fire from his house.
Good.
All kinds of figurines and
yeah,
things.
That would be good.
Yeah. Any other personalities? Maybe,
well, Elizabeth Chater, she was a somewhat later one. She was a very good teacher and a very, really sacrificed herself, a very hard worker. That's Chater, I think is correct.
Yeah, that's Chater, right. Uh-huh.
Elizabeth Chater. And she did, after her retirement, she did a bunch of romances with the setting turn of the 1800s setting.
She's still doing that.
I think
she's still writing.
Good for her.
What I find interesting is the way she changed from science fiction to romance novels.
She helped people. She would just knock herself out working on people's manuscripts. I mean, that was beyond the call of duty to do as much work as she did, practically serving as an agent. Some of her students.
Is that right?
Yeah, she just
right?
She was right next to me up there in the second floor of the social sciences. We lost that building allegedly because Jack Adams flipped a coin with the social science person as to who got that building. He lost, so they took the building, and we moved up the hill to what's now Hepburn. But of course, eventually we ended up in the New
Adams Humanities. You used to be down below
Social
Sciences building, which is now Nassatier Hall and
yeah.
Storm Hall.
Yeah.
And you moved up to Hepner Hall?
Yeah.
Temporarily.
I had a former kitchen right by the gallery there, best office I ever had. A little nook that came in through here.
Yeah.
Across from him was a man who wrote in history, I can't think of his name now, wrote a good book on Lincoln and got some favorable publicity. Made a lecture series on Lincoln. What was his name? Jim something. He'll come in sometime. I started out in Quonset huts, in the little corrugated wartime huts. That's where they had us. And
of course,
when I was there, when I came in with Lowell Tozier, and of course when I came temporarily, I was in Hepburn Hall again in Maple Trail's office. But when I came back, we were put in a Quonset hut. 5 or 6 of us, and then later I was in one by us with just one person. That was Jerry Kiffard in French. I remember Jerry Kiffard. One way to make him furious, I was told by one of my students, was when new students came in and addressed him as Dr. Pifford. That made him very angry.
Pifford, better be careful. Oh, that's funny. Well, about the buildings on campus when you came in, obviously there was a big growth in the student population then.
Yeah.
And
there
not
five,
enough
when
buildings
I came,
around.
It was 5,000, which was the same as we had at Maine, 5,000.
Uh-huh.
And then it went from there on.
It grew very quickly. How many Quonset huts were on campus at one time? I only have pictures of scattered ones here and there, and I know that there were many.
I don't know. I couldn't say. There was that one, which I can't even tell just where it was to begin with, but it was kind of the upper part of the campus, I mean toward student Aztec Hall and so on, somewhere in there, I don't know where the bookstore and so on. Then there was one down below, sort of where the arts, fine arts is.
Yeah.
That's where I was with Jerry
Kiffard,
I'd be careful. There were some others, but I don't remember a tremendous number. There were a certain number.
There's only one still existing on campus.
Oh, really? I didn't know there was any.
They use it actually for shipping and receiving, central mail and things
like
that.
Oh, yes, I know what you mean. Yes,
mm-hmm.
I know what you mean. Sure.
Yeah.
Go down there to get keys.
We have good good, we have a couple of good pictures of a Quonset hut serving as a bookstore temporarily.
Yes,
right, off of the quad.
Yeah, that's right.
How about Lee Gerlach?
Lee, I didn't know too well. He was our poet, and one of the early writers brought in Jack was interested. And Sydney both interested, I guess, in getting some people to teach writing courses and so on.
Uh-huh.
So Lee Gerlach was a poet. See, he went from state down to USD. So did a man Freitas, I guess was his name, F-R-E-I-T-A-S, Freitas, who was in Portuguese. Freitas was very much taking one of my books about Vasco da Gama.
Huh.
And he went down to USD also. And of course, Nassatier taught a course at USD when after he retired, when they had a system by which Abe wanted to continue teaching for a little while. He was a very good teacher. But the system was, as I understand it, was that you had to get the, had to be, have a vote of the department whether they wanted you to do it or not. And that was a terrible thing because they voted not.
How funny.
He was a man with a national reputation. It was a conflict of interest. I mean, you take him out and everybody can move up. You leave him in and it keeps people down. So USD offered him a job instead for a half year or a year.
Huh.
Now, you'd have to check the facts on that, but that's my memory of how it happened. Kramer Rofleisch would know. He's in the history department. He would know whether that's an accurate account. I'm sure that he did teach down at USD for a semester.
I didn't realize that he was down there.
And I understood that he couldn't make it in the department. We had to vote, the English department had to vote on whether to allow a couple of people to get married. I forget which two it was. But there was
a nepotism
thing, and if you're going to violate that, and these people had decided to get married. Oh, I know who they were, but I can't, I can see them now, but I can't bring their names back. And they had met and fallen in love and so forth after they were both members separately of the department. Now they wanted to be married. Well, they were already established as separate members, so it would have been pretty nasty to vote them, deny them marriage.
Or was it Naur?
No, I don't think either of those.
Harold Jaffe.
I can see there. They left. They wanted to. They became a little discouraged with some of the conflicts in the department, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they went up to Oregon or Washington and wanted to have a career as writer, as freelance writers. It was a horrible fate, I think. But
you think that's a horrible fate? I think that would be absolutely wonderful.
Not horrible, but a little too uncertain for me.
A little too risky.
Yeah. No, it wouldn't be horrible. No, I remember my office mate back in Maine saying when we learned about our writing, said, "Oh, that's the ideal way to live. You just have your own office, your home. You,
mm-hmm.
you have your." And we felt the same way too. We felt the same way for years. But then, when I came out here, I decided there was something because I could only come out. I didn't mention this, I could only come out as a part-time to begin with. And so that meant that more than before we were dependent on the freelancing, which we were doing. But not only that, as Juanita said, there's nothing to worry about. She said we had the college reading anthology, which was doing well at that time, so I really didn't have, but I thought, well, I don't like this even being dependent for half of my salary on that. And after one semester, they said this was just a transition. I could have as much teaching as I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So after a semester, I think I want 3/4. So like 3/4. I think I'd like full time.
You want full time.
So it didn't go with my temperament. It'll go with Anita's. She's the creative one.
I'll ask you more about her towards the end of the interview. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what some of the milestones were for the English department? Can you think of anything in particular? Have you been able to come up with anything? Maybe the graduate program?
Let's see. That's a good question, but someone like, well, let's see. Well, I've mentioned the, well, one thing Sidney Gulick was interested in was getting a MA organized for creative writing, and that was achieved, and he was, had a something to do with it right at the very beginning. When I came out in 55, there was a lady whose name I can't remember. She'd written a very good dramatic play, a drama, set in the Philippines, where she had been at about the time of the war, just before the war.
Hmm.
And So that was, I believe, the first creative writing MA that we had.
Huh.
And Sidney and I were the directors of it, and he wanted me to be in on it because of our own writing. And in order to meet the requirements of the graduate division at that time, it had to have some scholarly aspects. So the author wrote an introduction, a long introduction, kind of analyzing and explaining how she'd gone about it and so on. So that was a scholarship.
That was a scholarly aspect.
That was a scholarly. And so that went through. So then I'd say the development of that, that would be a milestone, certainly. I didn't have too much to do with it. They brought me out for that, but then pretty soon they expanded that, and I wanted to do the medieval, and that was all right with them. So I kind of moved over to that, and I did for several years. When I first came out, I taught the creative writing,
mm-hmm.
and I can remember teaching that down by in the building across from the fine arts. What I can remember there is having the papers read, and of course you get some eccentric people in the creative writing. I remember one man who said he couldn't stand when another lady read her works. He said she was just like a big pink marshmallow. He couldn't stay in the room, he said. So I said, well, do what you have to do.
So we had to get up and leave. Huh?
And I don't remember that I sat in the back of the room, and then this class one semester met at about 3:30 or 4. And I had a terrible time staying awake. It was very hot down there, and I was in the back, and nobody could see me. And I would keep shaking my head,
Well, if you had gotten up at 4:30 in the morning to work for 3 hours before you came to work, and then after having eaten lunch, I can understand.
Anyhow, that would be a milestone, I guess. The further development of the master's program, which I guess I did have something to do with. I was a graduate coordinator
you
for
did.
Eight years, and a graduate advisor all the way through, and we introduced an MA which you could get the MA by passing advanced examinations in place of the thesis, and I guess that was a change. I don't know how important it was. So we had those options of the thesis or the examination routine,
yeah.
Road, I should say.
Yeah, I saw that had changed. I was reading some minutes of the meeting of the department,
mm-hmm.
and there was quite a bit of debate about that. They decided they were still going to have the oral exam.
Mm-hmm.
However, they needed to have a written thesis as well, or project.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As I say, you could get your MA without writing a thesis by taking these long written examinations. The way we did at Johns Hopkins, we had 8-hour exams there at the end. We also had an oral, though. We had two orals. We had an oral partway through, and that was the crucial one. And if you passed that, then you went on. And
the comprehensive exam, which they still have.
Say this again.
Comprehensive comps.
Yeah.
Which they still have in some instances for
yes.
some majors at
yeah.
San Diego State.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you
a defense about the graduate something a defensive thing, not a change, but this may have changed since then. But there was a battle for a while over the foreign language requirement, and I went all out naturally to try to defend that, which we did. We succeeded in hanging on to that, but we just hung on by the skin of our teeth. And I meant to ask him if I ever bump into Dan McLeod again. I was talking to him a year ago, but I haven't seen him since. I want to ask him whether that has survived or not, because that was just under constant attack. I don't know whether they still, I hope they still have it.
They still do, however, I think it's been eroded a little bit.
Mm-hmm.